After the dance, Skuld dragged Vigdis off to her room. To Utrina's growing sense of dread, the youngest Valkyrie was enrolled in the freshman class from B term on, because, the Norn insisted, it was past V's bedtime. Thus freed from her clinging, chattering presence, Corwin was able, rather sheepishly, to rejoin the duelists, and then the pack of them went trick-or-treating at Caitlin's insistence. Since that couldn't be done in Port Geradar, the hour was late, and anyway, the Bajoran local wouldn't have understood what the hell they were doing. They might even have gotten arrested. They piled into the one-hit wonder and went to Babylon 5 instead. There, they found Commander Johnson on his command deck, dressed as a barbarian chieftain, fur hauberk, iron axe, and all, which looked pretty comical on his skinny frame, especially combined with the bunny rabbits on his shoulders and his blue and raspberry-striped hair. Susan Ivanova was still in her Starfleet uniform, resolutely pretending that her commanding officer was not going around dressed as a primitive axe-toting plainsman who responded to every mention of Jer the Barbarian with a hearty, "I'm huge!" She and Major Kira seemed rather bemused that this pack of high schoolers, and an adult house guide, and two faculty members, wanted to go around trick-or-treating on the station, but Ivanova had no actual objection, and the commander thought it was a great idea, so Kira told Lieutenant Reed to make sure they stayed out of trouble and bade the kids have a good time. Just as they were gleefully turning to leave the command deck with their amused, in a very buttoned-down, British sort of way, escort in tow, the costumed duelists were met at the doors by Captain Derek Bacon. Bacon, too, was in costume, his WDF comm badge and rank bars discreetly attached to a bright green lab coat. He had a round mirror strapped to his forehead and a stethoscope around his neck. Spotting the duelists, he grinned in greeting. Then he caught sight of Utrina, grinned more broadly, held out a hand to indicate her like a game show presenter, and boomed in a vaguely musical manner, "Spear and magic helmet!" Jareth the Barbarian popped out his office door and chimed in, "Magic helmet!" From the hallway behind Bacon, a bald, broad-shouldered, vaguely cynical-looking man in a World War II U.S. Army paratrooper's uniform shouldered past the WDF captain, no mean feat, and added, "Magic helmet!" Things became very operatic in the Babylon 5 command center for a few minutes, while Susan Ivanova sat at her station, buried her face in her hands, and looked very much like she might be thinking about crying. Behind her, a smiling Kira Nerys put a sympathetic hand on her shoulder and said nothing. Once that was over with, Bacon transacted some simple business with a recovered Lieutenant Commander Ivanova, then introduced his ship's Chief of Security, one Michael Garibaldi. The captain and Garibaldi then joined the duelist's party, because, hey, free candy! As they roamed around the station, beeping doors and making their ritual demands, Bacon and Garibaldi recruited other adults, including a very confused Ambassador Delenn. "I have no costume." "Oh, don't worry, you can come as a Minbari diplomat." "I am a Minbari diplomat." "Well, that makes you more convincing." Into the cadre. By the time they were done, there were almost 30 of them. Duelists, friends, a house guide, two teachers, two WDF officers, three members of the diplomatic staff, several IPO security officers, four off-duty maintenance technicians, two members of the crew of the IKV Hoskaj, and a couple of crewmen from a Cyberman trading vessel that happened to be in port. The sorts of things such a pack of trick-or-treaters gets when making the rounds of a diplomatic space station are left as an exercise for the reader. The first week of fall break was spent, by the new Art of Noise, deep in final rehearsals for their much-anticipated return to the stage on the following Saturday. On Friday morning, they packed their gear into Moose's van, rode it down to the spaceport, and loaded it aboard the One-Hit Wonder, which Corwin had loaned to Utrina for the trip. She, grinning widely at the thought of her first solo stint in command with a proper destination, flew them to New Hokkaido by Metaspace, which took the better part of the day. It was like their old trips to Toronto on a grander scale. The band, their sound man and rhythm guitarist in training, and the beautiful and talented road crew of Utrina, Wakaba, and Juriari Sugawa, who had replaced Dorothy when the robot girl joined the band, slept in orbit that night to save on parking fees. The next afternoon they put down in the city of New Sapporo, real original types, the first new Hokkaido colonists, and disembarked, destination, the amusingly named Club Heavy Heavy. The Heavy Heavy was a big, garishly lit, weirdly upholstered club, but it handled the heavy crowd noise in such a way that Kate suspected it would have good acoustics, and the stage looked spacious and comfortable to play. The patrons were in a cheery enough mood, and the manager was pleasant and polite. All in all, it looked like a pretty good place to play. Unfortunately, the Art of Noise wouldn't find out tonight, because, the manager informed them sheepishly, they wouldn't be playing. Half an hour ago, the call had come in from the media conglomerate which owned the company, which owned the club, informing the manager that the media company's record label's hot new number one single-holding rock group, the Superconducting Super Colliders, would be playing a surprise show at his club tonight, and was that all right with him? Well, of course it was all right, it had to be, but... The opening acts had been local. They had been informed of the change in plans by phone, all but one of them called off. The Art of Noise had already been in transit, though, already at the spaceport by that point in time. There'd been no time. The poor man was sweating and nervous, so apologetic he seemed almost ready to offer to commit ritual suicide for the dishonor of having them dragged all this way not to play a show. Could he at least offer them free admission to the Collider's show and some complimentary refreshments for their trouble? As it happened, Kate liked the Collider's. Their number one single, Strange Attractor, got frequently stuck in her head when she cruised the Autobahn with Vlad the Impala's radio tuned to Babylon 5's Armed Forces radio station. So, since they were already here, she might as well listen to them play. She did her best to give the manager a reassuring smile, turned to Jury, and gave her a nod. Jury nodded as well, though she didn't dare smile at the poor man. He'd probably take it as predatory, and either wet himself from fright or pass out. At any rate, she didn't really feel like smiling at him. She knew it wasn't really his fault, that he was being jerked around by the corporate masters of the corporate masters of his own direct employers, but still, did he have to be so spineless about it? "This is not good business," she told him coolly, "but we accept your attempt at compensation in the spirit in which it's offered." "Oh, thank you," said the manager, bowing. "Please pick a table, any table." As they left the bar and started looking for a table, Moose grinned wryly and said, "Maybe we should make you the band manager." Jury gave him a little smile and replied, "Well, I have been told that I'm persuasive." There were enough of them that they actually had to take two tables, up close to the stage. They sat around for a few minutes, discussing this irritating turn of events, while they should have been setting up. And while they were doing this, the stage door opened, and another small group of people emerged onto the stage, equipment in hands. The crowd in the club didn't pay them much attention. After all, this was a surprise show. They weren't looking for one of the number one bands in the galaxy to appear on stage. They thought they knew who was playing already. The usual crop of college bands and some kind of wunderkind band from that new private school near Bajor. Corwin, his mother, his half-brother Leonard, the Shannon twins, Nal, Fuhooji, Sionji, Erd, Mia, and Belana Torres arrived shortly thereafter. Koopman Memorial High in New Avalon, where Corwin, Nall, Len, and the Shannons went to school, wasn't on break, so they'd had to wait for classes to get out today, then come to New Hokkaido separately via Dagger Disc's fold drive. They were dismayed to see the band not setting up, and when Jury explained the reason why, Corwin's face darkened and he slammed a fist into the opposite palm. "Clarissa," he snarled. "What?" said Jury, puzzled. "The Super Colliders are signed with Ziggurat Records," said Fu, nodding in agreement with Corwin. "And guess who owns Ziggurat?" asked Len. Kate glanced up at him, then nodded slowly, her face taking on a look of dark understanding. "As technology, she said. As if summoned, Clarissa Broadbank and a few other students from DSM, Carol Alverson and that boring young man she was dating, student council treasurer Marcus Finch, and, Corwin was disturbed to notice, Vigdis Brightblade, entered the club, smiling and chatting with great private amusement about something. Seeing Kate and the others up front, Clarissa made a great show of smiling broadly and waving in a friendly manner at them before she and her party went to a booth back in the corner to sit down and continue their conversation. Vigdis seemed to feel Corwin's surprised eyes on her. She looked up, made brief eye contact with him, and went red, then glanced to his side, scanned the table he was next to, and scowled before pointedly turning away, ignoring him. "What was that all about?" he wondered. "This bites," said Nall indignantly. "Who do these jerks think they are? Just because they've got a number one single, they think they can come in here and push out the Art of Noise?" One of the young men setting up equipment on the stage, a spiky-haired, toffee-colored man in his mid-20s, paused, looked up, and then came over to the edge of the stage and crouched down. "Excuse me," he said, "did your cat just say the Art of Noise?" "I'm not a cat, you gig-stealing—" "Nall," Corwin snapped, closing his fist around the little dragon's muzzle. "Shut up." declared Nall indignantly. Kate looked down at the table, then back up, and said softly, yes. We're the Art of Noise. The young man sat back on his heels, pumped a fist in the air, and said, "Awesome!" They all stared at him in amazement. "Mark Ramsey," said the spiky-haired man, leaning down from the stage to shake Kate's hand. "Lead singer of the Super Colliding Superconductors. I mean, Superconducting Super Colliders. Damn, I do that every time," he added with a sheepish grin. "I shouldn't have let Fermi pick out the band name, no matter who he's descended from. Anyway, you must be Caitlin Hutchins. I'm really pumped to meet you." Kate blinked. Me? "Yeah. I've got a crystal of your Toronto show from last March. A buddy of mine sent it to me on the net. I think you know him. Joe Groff?"
You know Joe?
"Oh, yeah. I was a senior at Toronto U when he was a freshman, eh? I taught him that wanky C minor seventh transition he uses in half his damn songs," he added with a broad grin. "You guys come in here to catch the show? I thought it was supposed to be a surprise. Hell, we didn't know we were playing here till tonight. We were up in the hills skiing when our A&R guy calls up. 'Go play the heavy, favor for the big boss.' 'Sure, okay, whatever.'" He mimed hanging up a phone. "So what brings you to New Sapporo?"
"We were supposed to be headlining here tonight," Dorothy Wainwright told him bluntly. Ramsey blinked.
"Oh," he said. "And they bumped you for us? Man, that sucks."
"Mark, what's up?" asked a slim Andorian girl, coming up behind him. "Got those monitors hooked up yet?"
"Gina, this is the Art of Noise," said Ramsey, gesturing to the table. "They were supposed to be playing here tonight, and we bumped them."
Gina's antennae straightened in surprise.
"No kidding? That sucks." "I was just saying that," Ramsey agreed, sounding indignant. He turned. "Hey, Ricky!"
A tall, wire-thin white guy with no hair, a jet-black goatee, and rose-colored sunglasses looked up from where he was plugging together a keyboard setup.
"Yeah? Go get the manager."
"Why me?"
"Because you're perfect."
"Okay."
Said Kate. We really don't want to cause any trouble.
"Hell with it," said Ramsey, gesturing dismissively. "I'm in the same room with the band that did Alive Again. I'm damn well going to hear 'em play." He grinned, winked, and said, What's the use in selling a million records an hour if you can't push the record company around a little? And so it was. Clarissa Broadbent got to sit in the corner booth at the club Heavy Heavy and watch and listen with dismay as the Universal Brotherhood of Musicians defeated her inaugural scheme. The Art of Noise played a shorter set than they'd anticipated, having been changed from the headlining act to one of the two openers, but it was enough to qualify as a triumphant return, and besides, they were opening for the Super Colliders, for Pete's sake. She was in a terrible mood for the rest of the break. B term opened uneventfully. Professor Ravenhair's Applied Science Division quickly became the hot ticket in junior class registration. Students were jockeying for position, currying favor with the professor and the registrar's office, even trying to hack the registration computer in order to get seats in the C and D term installments of the class after hearing about all the fun they were having with force fields, model rocketry, robotics, and remote-controlled weapons in Skuld's Division B. Utina, who had found herself in that division out of either serendipity or sheer nepotism, she'd never asked which, could bear out all the legends. It was the most fun she'd ever had in school. In the second week of the term, Belana Torres got tired of schlepping up and down the hill three or four times a day, applied for and received permission to move from the fourth floor of Hannibal Hamlin Hall to the castle. Though not a duelist yet, she'd only started training with Professor Krog 2 months before, she was part of the community, so, the logic went, she might as well live there. Mia Ausa, who hadn't found single-room life so much restful as she'd anticipated, as boring, had gladly taken her as a roommate. Ironically, Mia had tried the single experience the year before, when she moved into Galaxy House. Then, too, she'd decided it wasn't for her and moved next door, rooming with Skaya. When the assignments had been made for rooms in the castle, she'd decided the larger in-building community would offset the single-room effect. She was wrong, and so she was happy to have a roommate again now. If there was one sour note in Bilana's life, it was that she couldn't take junior-level applied science yet, and by the time she was old enough to, odds were that Professor Ravenhair, who was, after all, only a visiting instructor, would have left the institute and returned to NIT. On the other hand, if her college classes were that much fun, then Bilana knew what college she was going to. If there was another sour note in Bilana's life, it was that, as the duelist community's only freshman, she had to attend classes with Clarissa Broadbent and Vigdis Brightblade. Clarissa more so. Vigdis wasn't actually nasty to Bilana. She usually seemed preoccupied with something else, and generally didn't pay the half-Klingon girl any mind at all. Still, she hung around with Clarissa so much that, whenever the little red had appeared, Bilana knew that the snippy blonde couldn't be far away, and Clarissa was nasty to Bilana. Vigdis's association with Clarissa was cause for concern throughout the small corner of the duelist community who knew about the Valkyrier and Corwin Ravenhair's connection with them. She hadn't spoken to Utina since the Halloween dance, but that was, perhaps, not all that unusual. Freshmen and juniors didn't cross paths much during the course of the term. Vigdis didn't try to join the Duelist Society. She joined the fencing club, where, Jury and Mickey reported, she was a bit irritable, but followed the rules. Caitlin passed her concerns on to Skuld, who sighed and said she hoped it was just a phase the littlest Valkyrie was going through. To those closer to the issue than the visiting professor, it was fairly obvious what the problem was. Every Friday, when Corwin appeared on campus for his weekly non-date with Utina, Vigdis would seem to materialize out of nowhere and try to intercept him with some cockamamie excuse or another. Every week, one or another of the clued-in duelists would in turn intercept her, diverting her just long enough for the beleaguered friends to make their escape. Every week, Vigdis would twig to the dodge just a bit too late, then stomp off to Hamlin to sulk. Slumped in the corner booth at Celestial Pizza, Gerardo's best pizzeria, also Gerardo's only pizzeria, Utina sighed and said, "I don't think I can take much more of this." Corwin nodded, mirroring her sigh. "What is with her, anyway?" Utina gave him a look. Corwin, don't be an idiot. She's got a huge crush on you, she thinks I'm your girlfriend, and she's jealous as hell.
Corwin blinked.
What?
No, no, no. I explained all that. The whole Valkyrie thing, it's a joke. She's just doing it to tick me off.
But, he said plaintively, why doesn't she realize it's not funny? I didn't think she was this dense.
Utina's shoulders slumped. She gave the top of her soda an exasperated look and muttered,
not half as dense as you.
Huh? Said Corwin.
Nothing, Utina replied.
Look, even if it is a joke, why don't you play along? Call her bluff, take her out. If she's kidding, she'll get scared and back off. If not...
She shrugged, giving him a sly look.
Then you might just get yourself a girlfriend.
It gave her kind of a funny, empty feeling to say that, but she put it down to hunger. Where the heck was their pizza, anyway?
I don't want a girlfriend, Corwin replied testily. He'd picked up his straw, still wrapped, and was rolling it between his fingers in a complex dance that briefly threatened to mesmerize Utina before she shook her head and forced herself to concentrate on the matter at hand. She really was very hungry.
So tell her that, she said. Not the way you have been, but seriously. Sit her down and lay it out for her. If there's even a chance she's serious, then the longer you let this go on, the worse it'll get for her. You've got to let her down before she ends up with too far to fall. And if she's not serious, maybe you telling her so seriously will clue her in that what she's doing isn't okay.
There was a pause while Corwin considered her words. Then, before she could stop herself, she said, anyway, I don't know why you don't at least consider it. I mean, she is awful cute.
Corwin stopped fidgeting with the straw. Carefully, deliberately, he unwrapped it, put it in his soda, bent it, and took a drink. Then he looked steadily at her with his blue eyes calm and rather sad, and said softly, you know why I don't. The uncomfortable moment hung there for a second, foreboding and acrid, like a cloud of smoke that's just been issued from a computer under repair. And then it was dispelled by the sudden appearance of a large pepperoni and Canadian bacon pizza, which plopped down onto the table between them with the abrupt finality of a slamming door.
"Celestial Pizza," declared the tall, apron-bedecked, blonde waiter with a grin. "Delivered on the wings of angels."
"Thanks, Zack," said Utina, grinning. "You're not delivering tonight?"
"I am if we get any delivery orders," Zack Stevens replied. "It's been dead. Not cold enough to keep people inside. They're just coming on down if they want a pie."
He glanced up, saw someone signaling from one of the other tables, and said,
"Eat in good health. Let me know if you need anything."
Celestial Pizza was a small wonder story nestled in the coda of the big wonder story that was the relocation of the Institute to Girado. Under the ownership of Bald Bill Hansen, with the help of his irrepressible deliverator, Zack Stevens, and a rotating staff of student help, it had been a Worcester fixture for years, delivering pizza to the desperate students of WPI. When the Institute went under, Hansen had considered retiring. But instead, at Zack's urging, he'd embarked on a grand adventure instead, picking up his establishment and moving it to Port Gerardar. Zack had promptly thrown himself into learning every road, street, and back alley in the greater Port Gerardar area. Given that, even with the rapid growth sparked by the Institute, the population hadn't yet topped 5,000, this task wasn't all that difficult for a deliveryman of Zack's caliber. When the deedlit Satori Mandeville Memorial Institute opened its doors, Celestial Pizza was there waiting for its hungry students' calls, and the students had not failed to respond. As the local population discovered pizza, not unknown on Bajor itself, which was becoming more cosmopolitan every day now that Babylon 5 was online, but heretofore utterly unknown on Girado, business had gotten better and better. Now it wasn't uncommon for Celestial Pizza to make its way up to the station itself by way of the regular shuttle runs, nor was it far out of the ordinary for crewmen from the Challenger, Hoskage, or Derek Bacon's WDF command, the battleship Pennsylvania, to beam in for dinner on non-patrol nights. Celestial had been one of Corwin and Utina's favorite Friday night haunts last year. To eat there this year, too, had a certain faintly but pleasingly surreal feeling, like eating in the Marché on B5 and not knowing for a moment whether they were in the Zocalo or the concourse of the entire state building in New Avalon. The pizza was damn good, too. "Sorry," said Corwin as he reached for the grated cheese shaker. "She's just got my nerves on edge. I mean, I like V. I really do. She can be sweet when she's not being a pain in the ass, and she really does care about her work. But she's got an arrogant streak. Doesn't think much of mortals. I think it really squicks her that Aunt Bell, Lady Vertandi of the World Tree, is married to one and lives with him in Midgard. Notice how uncomfortable she's been around Bell since she got here?" Ushna nodded. "I was wondering about that," she said around the tip of her first slice. "If what you're saying is right," Corwin went on, "she probably holds that against you as much as anything else. It's always bugged her that Mom's raised me to think of myself as belonging to both worlds." Ushna gave him a quirky grin. "Funny that she'd have such a major crush on you," she said, "seeing as you're half-mortal yourself." "Well, the Midgard knight slew Fenris," said Corwin importantly. "That makes him barely acceptable," he added wryly, dropping the pretense. Utina sighed. "Great, so she's a snob and the jealous type. Reminds me of somebody I used to know. At least I'm not her brother. Ew. There is that." They got back up to campus after spending most of the evening, after eating, walking around Lake Geradar and talking about random things. The far side of the lake, equidistant from the campus and the town, was very dark, but neither was afraid of the dark, so that didn't bother them. It was, in fact, a perfect place to be if you wanted to look at the stars. Which, to her continued surprise, Utrina Tenjo did. From here, when Bajor was less than a quarter full, a sharp-eyed observer who knew where to look could spot Babylon 5 on a clear night, its solar panels winking in the darkness. With binoculars, you could even see the Metagate working, and occasionally catch Bahavael's rays winking off the iridescent hull of the Challenger as she patrolled the inner system. As for the stars themselves, Epsilon Eridani was close enough to Sol that many of the familiar constellations looked more or less the same. Corwin knew them from Earth, Tomodachi, and Zeta Cygni, and was fast learning the differences here. Months ago, before she'd known him well enough to trust him with the reasons why, Corwin had stubbed his toe on Utrina's history with astronomy. They'd been standing up near Bancroft Tower in late March, and he'd suddenly pointed into the sky and said, "See that red star there? That's..." "I'm not interested in stars," Utrina snapped. "Don't talk to me about them." Corwin, astonished, skidded to a halt, spreading his hands in surrender. "Okay," he said softly. "Okay. Sorry." He hadn't mentioned it again until after she'd told him the abridged version of her story, which had included the fact that Akio Otori had claimed to be an astronomer as part of his campaign of deception. Corwin still didn't know the details of that part. He'd only been told that Akio had pretended to be a friend and turned out to be a deadly enemy. That was enough, though, to make him retroactively apologize for having tried to point out a star. It was just that he really was keen on astronomy, and so it was a natural thing for him to think of mentioning. His earnestness had touched her, and that summer, when he'd had to teach her cosmography as part of her starflight training, that same earnestness and his real passion for the subject had been like a bandage on that particular wound in her heart, sealing it up, helping it heal. She found herself warming to the subject again, rediscovering the genuine interest that she'd felt before. The stars here were different. Hell, the cosmology was different. But that was all to the good. It meant that, her initial reflexive revulsion overcome, she could learn it without painful reminders at familiar places, because there weren't any. Come to think of it, Corwin had done that, without really meaning to, for a number of the wounds her time with Akio had left in Utrina Tenjo. Fast cars, stargazing, illusory reality, confiding in and trusting a handsome, attentive fellow. One by one, Corbin had taken the threat out of all of them, shown her the real magic that lay beneath the deceptive veneer, given her the power to take them and appreciate them for herself, on her own terms. He was like a bomb, like an antidote, methodically undoing the damage that silver-tongued bastard had left in his wake. And that, Utna concluded as they reached the DSM front gates, was a big part of why she liked him so much, damn it. Vigdis Brightblade was waiting for them at the gate. Resolutely, Utna acted as though the glaring little Valkyrie weren't there. She hugged Corbin goodnight, just as she would have on any other day, kissed him on the cheek, just like any other day, and then trotted up the hill to the castle, turning once to wave to him, just like any other day. He waved back, then put his hands in his pants pockets and stood there, his breath puffing into a cloud in front of him, regarding Vigdis. "V," he said, "this has to stop." "You're right," replied Vigdis softly. "I'm glad you've finally come to your senses." Corbin looked puzzled. "Huh?" "You broke up with her, right?" said Vigdis. "That's why the long walk after dinner, why you left her here instead of walking her all the way to the castle. Right?" Corbin shook his head. "I didn't walk her to the castle because she's a big girl and she can make it from the gate to the castle without my help. And because you were here and I wanted to talk to you, now. I didn't break up with her. I can't break up with her." "Why not?" "Because there's nothing to break up," said Corwin, throwing his hands up in frustration. "Utna and I are not dating, okay? We're not boyfriend and girlfriend. We're not anything. We just like to hang out together. We have a lot of common interests. Jesus, V, I go out to dinner sometimes with Ashika Shannon. Are you going to start stalking her, too? Maybe you should go after Aunt Yuri while you're at it. And Fu, and don't forget Buttercup Utonium. On second thought, stay the hell away from Buttercup. You copped an attitude with her like you did with Utna at the Halloween dance. She'd hit you so hard the Allfather would feel it." "You still insist you're not dating her?" "I do. I'm not," said Corwin flatly, his hands on his hips. "Then why won't you go out with me?" Vigdis asked. "Because..." Corwin sighed. "Damn it, V, this stupid joke has gone on long enough. Go back to Asgard and tell Hildi I goddamn well don't think it's funny anymore, will you? Tell her for me that I've had just about all I'm going to take." Vigdis stared at him, her eyes shining in the muted light of the gate lamps. Then she sniffed, then sniffed again. "Why do you hate me?" she whispered. Corwin blinked. "Hate you? I don't hate you, V. I..." He trailed off as she still struggled not to cry. "Aw, damn it," he murmured and put his hands on her shoulders. "V, you're not playing the Valkyrie game, are you?"
No,
she wailed and threw herself against him. Not knowing what else to do, he put his arms around her and patted her back. "Aw, V," he muttered. "Damn it, I'm sorry. I thought you were just playing the bet board game like all the other girls. I never figured you were serious."
"Well, I was,"
said Vigdis into the comfortingly rough corduroy of his fluffily padded jacket.
"I am."
The words spilled out of her now as though she were afraid that, if she didn't get them out fast enough, they would spoil inside her and poison her.
"I'm not playing anybody's game, and if that girl's really not your girlfriend, then I want to be."
"Aw, V," Corwin repeated, rocking her a little on her feet. "I'm sorry. I know how you feel. I really, really do. You can't imagine how well I do, but you can't be. You can't. I'm sorry." She wrestled herself out of his arms and confronted him, her face sad and angry at the same time.
"Why not?" she demanded. "If you don't have one and you don't hate me, then why not?"
Corwin kept his grip on her shoulders, looked down into her angry, teary eyes, and said softly, "I don't think I can explain it, Vigdis, so that you'd understand it." She wrenched herself out of his hands and spat, "Don't treat me like I'm a little kid, damn you! Don't you dare tell me I'll understand when I'm older!" Corwin put his hand behind his head and chuckled wryly. "I don't see why you should," he told her. "I'm older and I don't."
"Now you're just making fun of me! You do hate me!"
He spread his hands. "No, V, I don't," he said pleadingly. "Please, listen, I can try to explain, but..."
"Save it!" Vigdis shrilled. "You know what, Corwin Ravenhair? It's okay if you hate me, because I hate you too!"
Then she whirled and sprinted away, bound for Hannibal Hamlin Hall, the hollow sounds of her cries echoing behind her. Well, thought Corwin as he stood alone at the gates of the school and looked at his watch, I could have handled that better. Then he turned around and started walking dejectedly back down to Port Geradar and his bed aboard the One-Hit Wonder. Vigdis slammed into her room, still alternately sobbing and raging, tore off her coat, kicked off her shoes, and threw herself onto the bed. She wasn't sure how long she stayed there, pounding the mattress with her fists and wishing one of the three of them, at this point she didn't care which, would just die. When she looked up, cried out for the moment, she saw Clarissa Broadbank sitting in her desk chair, looking at her with a concerned look. "Bad date?" Clarissa asked solicitously. Vigdis snorted derisively, which didn't work very well, since she was stuffed up from crying. It turned into more of a honking cough, then sent her fumbling for a tissue. Clarissa thoughtfully provided one from a pack she carried in her pocket, then waited patiently for Vigdis to clear her tubes and start over. Some people around here, mostly Corwin's half-sister Caitlin, the Pink Menace's roommate, and her stuck-up band friends, seemed to dislike Clarissa, but Vigdis thought she was nice. She'd helped the young Valkyrie get acclimated to the differences about the surface world faster than her orientation manual or Skuld had managed. Of course, Skuld was a bit distracted, what with her new teaching job and all, and part of the point of a surface world training assignment was to get accustomed to dealing with Midgard and its inhabitants on their own terms. Well, Clarissa had been a big help in that regard. She was smart, and more than that, she was wise. She knew the way things worked down here, and how to turn the flaws inherent in the system to one's own advantage, and she was willing to share that information. All a person had to do in return was be a friend to her, and Vigdis had been more than willing to be that. Sure, Clarissa was immortal, and so somewhat limited. It was Vigdis's considered opinion that they couldn't feel true passion, for example. But within those limitations, she was helpful to know. Now she listened quietly as Vigdis poured out the whole sorry tale, start to finish, edited, of course, to fit within the cover story mandated by her surface world assignment. She and Corwin were childhood playmates. True. And Vigdis worked for his mother. True, she was Skuld's student assistant, and they had always been very close. Stretching a point a little, maybe, but not in Vigdis's mind, until this pink-haired interloper had driven them apart. And the worst part of it was, he wasn't even receiving anything from her in return for snubbing his one true love, Vigdis Brightblade. The menace kept him wrapped around her finger and didn't give back the love she'd forced him to give to her. She believed Corwin when he told her that part, the last time he'd told her. There was no way he could have had that look in his eyes and be lying. So why? What was the point of it? Clarissa nodded sagely. "Some women like to do that kind of thing," she said, "just for the joy of making others suffer." "But why? Why does he put up with it? He's so handsome and strong and good. Why doesn't he just tell her to leave him alone?" "Maybe he can't," Clarissa suggested. "Can't?" Vigdis replied, looking confused. "Maybe she's bewitched him," said Clarissa. "There is magic in this world, you know. You've said so yourself." Vigdis blinked. Why hadn't she ever thought of that? It was the obvious answer, of course. The girl, Tencho, she was living with Corwin's Aunt Erd, a notorious meddler and alchemist, the good-for-nothing black sheep of the Norns. Erd must have taught her the forbidden arts, and she'd used them to bind Corwin's heart in thrall. That was why Corwin had kept saying, "I'm sorry," why he couldn't explain why he couldn't accept Vigdis's love.
"Of course," she whispered. "You're right. That has to be it. Thank you, Clarissa. I don't know how I could have missed it. It was right in front of my face."
Clarissa nodded, smiling. "You're welcome," she said. "Well, good night, Vigdis." She got up and left the single room, closing the door behind her. Vigdis sat thinking for a few moments, then nodded to herself, turned out her light, got undressed, and got into bed. "Of course she's bewitched him," she thought. "It's the only explanation that makes any sense. Don't worry, Corwin. I'll get stronger, and then I'll break the spell she holds you under. Hold on. Wait for me. Don't give in."
She drifted off to sleep, thinking heroic thoughts like that. As she went down the hall to her own room, Clarissa Broadbank chuckled. What a simpleton that girl was. Magic, indeed. If she really did think that Tenjo had put a spell on Caitlin's half-brother, well, then this ought to put the cat among the pigeons. Clarissa bedded down with a smile on her face, anticipating the fun.